This episode of the King's Hall podcast is brought to you by Joe Garrisey with Backwards Planning Financial, by our friends at Alpine Gold, by Max D Trailers, by Salt and Strings Butchery, Private Family Banking, Squirrely Joe's Coffee, and finally by Premier Body Armor.
Just months after the terrorist attacks on the Twin Towers on September 11, 2001, former President Bill Clinton spoke to an audience at Georgetown University. In his talk, he said that those of us who come from various European lineages are not blameless because of the West's involvement in the Crusades, which he called a crime against Islam. He then summarized an account of all the blood that was spilled when Duke Godfrey and his forces conquered Jerusalem in 1099. Similarly, the New York Times said in 1999 that the Crusades were comparable to Hitler's atrocities and the ethnic cleansing that occurred in Kosovo. That same year, a former nun, Karen Armstrong, shared her opinion on the Crusades. Crusading answered a deep need in the Christians of Europe, yet today, most of us would unhesitantly condemn the Crusades as unchristian. After all, Jesus told his followers to love their enemies, not to exterminate them. He was a pacifist and had more in common with Gandhi, perhaps, than Pope Urban, end quote. She also echoed a modern liberal sentiment that holy war cannot jive with the pacifism of Jesus. One former priest, James Carroll, agreed, saying that the Crusades left a trail of violence that scars the earth and human memory even to this day. Such claims date back to the Enlightenment, a time period in which British and French intellectuals invented the term Dark Ages to vilify the Catholic Church and elevate themselves in its place. David Hume, for example, said that the Crusades were the most signal and most durable monument to human folly that has yet appeared in any age or nation, end quote. German Lutheran church historian Johann Lorenz von Mosheim, who lived from 1693 to 1755, was probably the origin of the Crusaders as Western imperialists' false narrative. He said the motivations for crusading should be ascribed to a mixture of superstition and fanaticism. Later, Edward Gibbon said that the Crusaders went in pursuit of mines of treasure, gold and diamonds, of palaces of marble and jasper, and of odoriferous groves of cinnamon and frankincense. By the 1980s, the anti-Western narrative had picked up steam. One scholar said, "Our verdict on the Crusades is that it amounted to a colonial exploitation." Karen Armstrong said, "These were our first colonies." Rodney Stark summarizes the modern popular consensus on the Crusades in this way. During the Crusades, an expansionist, imperialistic Christendom brutalized, looted, and colonized a tolerant, peaceful Islam. This narrative is patently false, as even a growing number of secular historians like Rodney Stark have long pointed out. We'll get to the real story in just a moment. But first, we wanted to ask a pivotal question. Why is the progressive, secular, Marxist left so hell-bent on destroying the true history of Christendom and its heroes? To answer this question, we want to turn now to the cultural prophet, Patrick J. Buchanan, who wrote the following words in 2002, long before critical race theory or wokeness had swallowed up the discourse of everyday American lives. Buchanan writes, "Alexander Solzhenitsyn was right when he said, 'To destroy a people, you must first sever their roots.' How does one sever a people's roots? Answer, destroy its memory. Deny people the knowledge of who they are and where they came from. If we forget what we did, we won't know who we are," said Ronald Reagan in his farewell address to the American people. "I am warning of the eradication of the American memory that could result ultimately in an erosion of the American spirit," end quote. In the Middle Ages, Ottoman Turks imposed on Balkan Christians a blood tax. One boy out of every five taken from their parents, the boys were raised as strict Muslims to become the fanatic elite soldiers of the Sultan, the Janissaries, who were then sent back to occupy and oppress the peoples who had borne them. For a modern state, the formula for erasing memory was given to us by Orwell in the party slogan of Big Brother. Who controls the past controls the future. Who controls the present controls the past. Destroy the record of a people's past. Leave it in ignorance of who its ancestors were and what they did, and one can fill the empty vessels of their soul with a new history, as in George Orwell's book, 1984. Dishonor or disgrace a nation's heroes, and you can demoralize its people. The cause of Irish independence was crippled by the revelation that the great Charles Stuart Parnell was living in adultery with the wife of Captain O'Shea. Baseball almost did not survive the Black Sox scandal of 1919, when the popular hero Shoeless Joe Jackson was found to have taken money from gamblers and his team had thrown the World Series. The loss of faith was caught in the kid's lament, "Say it ain't so, Joe." Richard Nixon's new majority was shattered by Watergate and the resignation of a resident and vice president who had carried 49 states. The success of Nixon's enemies in outing from office a hated adversary became the archetype for the politics of personal destruction, the defeat of causes by disgracing their flawed champions. It had become standard operating procedure in American politics. Cultural Marxists understood this. Their critical theory was a prototype of the politics of personal destruction. What the latter does to popular leaders, critical theory does to an entire nation through repeated assaults on its past. It is the moral equivalent of vandalizing the graves and desecrating the corpses of its ancestors. Many of the institutions that now have custody of America's past operate on the principles of Big Brother's Ministry of Truth, drop down the memory hole, the patriotic stories of America's greatness and glory, and produce new warts and all histories that play up her crimes and sins, revealing what we have loved to be loathsome and those we have revered to be disreputable, even despicable. Many old heroes have not survived the killing fields of the new history. Ultimate goal, destroy patriotism, kill the love of country, demoralize the people, deconstruct America. History, then, will no longer unite and inspire us, but depress and divide us into the children of victims and the children of the villains of America's past. A child's love of its mother grows naturally, but love of country must be taught. Only by learning can a child know of the people and nation to which he or she belongs. For those born before World War II, love of country came easy. Radio, movies, newspapers, comic books, and conversations conveyed the same message. We are a good and rising people, attacked without warning at Pearl Harbor. Many brave Americans had died there. Others were bayoneted on the death march in a place called Bataan. Now we were paying Japan back. There was a spirit of solidarity and unity, then unlike any we have known since. We were truly one nation, indivisible, and one people. But after the assassination of President Kennedy, an adversary culture arose that set about dynamiting America's legends, demythologizing her history and demolishing her heroes. With its media collaborators, this counterculture has left scarcely an institution unscarred or a hero unsullied. We grew up in an era of belief. We grow old in an era of disbelief, feebly fending off the relentless pounding of the artillery of an adversary culture that accepts no armistice.
Poignant words. To destroy a people, you must sever their roots from the historical past. The true histories of our Christian forefathers have to be sent down the memory hole. Nowhere is this instinct more obvious or openly hostile among today's ruling class and institutional educators than with the Crusades. Which brings us to a pivotal question. What really happened in the Crusades? What motivated them? In short, after centuries of bloody conquest by the Muslims into lands once held by Christendom, the West finally fought back. As we covered in a previous episode, Heraclius and the Byzantine Empire suffered a serious defeat at Yarmouk in 636 after the Muslim invasion. Huge percentages of once Christian lands were consumed by invading Muslim forces. Muhammad's upstart religion was notoriously bloodthirsty and violent, and the following centuries were therefore marked by continuous Muslim incursions into Christian territory. As a result, Christian heroes like El Cid and Charles Martel would engage in defensive campaigns to reconquer Christian lands and to free their people from the tyranny, rape, and forced slavery imposed by Islamic peoples. It was a brutal and intolerant age, and so, as Rodney Stark points out, efforts to portray Muslims as enlightened supporters of multiculturalism are, at best, ignorant. In November of 1095, at the height of the Muslim invasion, Pope Urban II spoke from a platform outside the French city of Clermont, surrounded by an enormous crowd. At 53 years of age, Urban retained his vigor and was blessed with an unusually powerful voice that reached across to the very edges of the assembled crowd in an era that didn't have electronic amplification. There, he gave a speech that would change history forever. Urban's speech was sparked by a dispatch that had arrived sometime earlier from Count Robert of Flanders, containing within it a letter from Alexius Comnenus, ruler of the Byzantine Empire. In the letter, Emperor Comnenus begged the Pope for aid. The Seljuk Turks, newly converted to Islam, had been radicalized and militarily mobilized by their new religion. They had begun a fanatical invasion to Christian territory. In their surprise invasion, they had routed Christian army after Christian army. They had devoured the city of Jerusalem and all the cities surrounding it. Tens of thousands of men strong, the Turks now made camp just 100 miles from the great city of Constantinople, the eastern bulwark of Christianity for the last 1,000 years. Constantinople seemed to be on the verge of defeat. The Byzantine emperor swore that if Constantinople fell, then all of Europe would follow with it. Alexius had started his letter by pleading and begging, and then ended it by promising the wrath of God on Urban if he should fail to help the Greeks. Alexius wrote, quote, "Therefore, in the name of God, we implore you to bring to this city all the faithful soldiers of Christ. In your coming, you will find your reward in heaven, and if you do not come, God will condemn you," end quote. Despite the long-standing rift between the Church of the Latin West and Eastern Byzantium, Pope Urban quickly grasped the severity of the situation. He rightly judged that if Constantinople fell, the rest of Europe and Christendom would be next. And so he went about preaching all across Europe to kings, knights, and farmers alike. At Clermont, Urban implored the leading men of Europe to rise to the defense of Jerusalem and all of Christendom. Speaking in French, he said, quote, "The Muslims destroy the altars, after having defiled them with their uncleanness. They circumcise the Christians, and the blood of circumcision they either pour on the altars or pour into the vases of the baptismal font. When they wish to torture a people by a base death, they perforate their navels, and dragging forth the extremity of the intestines, they bind it to a stake. Then with flogging, they lead the victim around until the viscera, having gushed forth, the victim falls prostrate on the ground. What shall I say to the abominable rape of women? To speak of it is worse than to be silent. On whom, therefore, is the labor of avenging these wrongs and recovering this territory incumbent, if not upon you?" Pope Urban went on, "Let those who have been fighting against their brothers and relatives now fight in a proper way against the barbarians. Let those who have been serving as mercenaries for small pay now obtain the eternal reward. Let those who have been wearing themselves out in both body and soul now work for a double honor. Behold, on this side will be the sorrowful and the poor, on that the rich. On this side the enemies of the Lord, on that his friends. Let those who go not put off the journey, but rent their lands and collect money for their expenses. And as soon as winter is over and spring comes, let them eagerly set out on the way with God as their guide," end quote.
In response to Urban's oration, the knights present began to cut pieces of clothing into strips, fashioning them into crosses and sewing them to their chests. This act was known as taking the cross. Hundreds of knights present partook of the action, effectively swearing their oaths to relieve their Eastern brethren of the oppression of the Islamic religion and military force. It was not lowly knights that swore oaths that day, but predominantly powerful members of the nobility, such as Count Raymond of Toulouse. As the crosses were made, cries of "Dieu le volte" rang out in French. The saying, translated in Latin as "Deus volt," means "the Lord wills it." It would become the rallying cry of the Crusades. which are conventionally defined as the conflicts between Christendom and Islam for control of the Holy Land that occurred between 1095 and 1291. Pope Urban's speech concluded, according to Baldrick, by his turning to the bishops and enlisting them to go preach the Crusades elsewhere. This was significant and necessary because, despite the will of the impassioned knights at Clermont, many thousands more would be needed to fight in a crusade against Islam. It's perhaps hard for modern American Christians, who have been leavened by the teachings of pietism and pacifism, to comprehend, but it was a deep sense of piety that caused Christian knights to respond to the call for a crusade. They enlisted in the cause because the world was a bloody mess, and they saw it as their job to defend Christendom and its cities. They heard the stories of Christian pilgrims being slaughtered and nuns being raped. It moved them to take action. Likewise, knights of that era were trained for and expected to be engaged in warfare. As Rodney Stark puts it, a knight was raised to regard fighting as his chief function, and throughout his life, the knight spent most of his time in practicing with his arms or actually fighting. Dull periods of peace were largely devoted to hunting on horseback such savage animals as the wild boar, end quote. Understanding the knight's motivation, Urban couched his offer to join in a crusade in terms of joining a monastic order. For the knight, there would be an imparting of a special holiness, a purging from sin, and a certainty of salvation for those who took part. Hubert of Nogent recalled Urban's words at Clermont, which were as follows. "God has instituted in our time holy wars, so that the order of knights, who have been slaughtering one another, might find a new way of gaining salvation, and so they are not forced to abandon secular affairs completely, but can attain some measure of God's grace while pursuing their own careers, with the liberty and dress to which they are accustomed," end quote. As Stark writes, tens of thousands of dedicated pacifists could do nothing to liberate the Holy Land. It was going to take an army of belligerent knights who were motivated, but not transformed by the promise of salvation. Thus, the invention of penitential warfare, end quote. As for who actually went on the First Crusade, it was largely groups of closely related families who already had wealth and status. They were mostly from the ruling class and went at great personal cost to themselves. There, of course, was a People's Crusade led by Peter the Hermit, but it was largely ineffective and was annihilated upon its arrival. More on that later. Stark writes, "Consider the family headed by Count William Tet Hardy of Burgundy. He had five sons. Of these, three went on the First Crusade, and the fourth became a priest who, as Pope Calixtus II, inaugurated an extension of the crusade to attack Damascus in 1122. Count William also had four daughters. Three were married to men who joined their brothers-in-law and went on the First Crusade, and the fourth was a mother of a First Crusader. As for the Second Crusade, this family sent 10 crusaders in 1147. Crusading was largely a family rather than individual enterprise because substantial sums of money had to be raised to supply the journey. Often, men were forced to mortgage entire estates to cover the cost of crusading. Crusading was a ridiculously expensive endeavor, which is why mainly nobility signed up. Knights needed armor, arms, preferably two or three war horses, a riding horse, many pack horses and mules, and various other supplies. For example, Guy of Thiers paid £10 for a war horse, which was equal to more than 2 years of salary for a ship's captain. Knights also needed servants, clothing, tenting, and cash for the journey. By Rodney Stark's estimate, the typical crusader needed to raise at least four or five times his annual income before he could set out. Likewise, it must be noted that roughly 10% responded to Urban's call, which means 90% did not. The reality was that crusading was expensive. Most would die on the way or in the fighting, and it was more likely to bring destitution, not financial gain. Likewise, far from establishing an imperial colony that would bring riches to Europe, the Crusades frequently became contentious because they drained resources and sent some of Christendom's best heroes to die in the Holy Land far from home. In the First Crusade, there were largely two camps, the People's Crusade and the Prince's Crusade. The People's Crusade was organized by Peter the Hermit, who'd gathered an impressive group in size thanks to his remarkable preaching. The People's Crusade, which also included Walter the Penniless, grew as large as 100,000 strong. It was composed of lowly knights, peasants, and even women and children. Because it lacked leadership, the People's Crusade often got sidetracked with pillaging along the way. In Bulgaria, for example, Peter's contingent could not be controlled, and after looting nearby towns, got into a heated conflict with the Bulgarians. Quote, "As many as a third of Peter's contingent were killed," writes Rodney Stark, "and many of their wagons were lost to the Bulgarians, including Peter's treasure wagon," end quote. The first to arrive in Constantinople in August of 1096, Peter's contingent was sent by the emperor to cross the Sea of Marmara and establish a camp at Helenopolis. He was joined there by Walter and his knights. After 2 months there, and a few successful pillaging runs in the direction of Nicaea, war fever broke out amongst the People's Crusade. Foolishly, they marched out against the Turks and were promptly and tragically slaughtered. Only a few knights, rescued by a Byzantine relief force, survived. All of the non-combatants, including women and children, were killed or enslaved. In the end, a lack of discipline and authoritative leadership doomed the People's Crusade. Alexius' daughter Anna wrote this about the slaughter. "So great a multitude of Celts and Normans died by the Ishmaelite sword that when they gathered the remains of the fallen lying on every side, they heaped up, I will not say a mighty ridge or hill or peak, but a mountain of considerable height and depth and width. So huge was the mass of bones. Of those who survived, most were decapitated, according to Raymond Ibrahim. Those who survived suffered an even worse fate. Of the survivors, it was written, the Turks divided up amongst themselves some of the captives, whose lives they had spared, or rather reserved for a more painful death, and submitted them to dismal servitude at the hands of cruel masters. Some were exposed in public, like targets, and were pierced by arrows. Others were given away as gifts, while others were sold outright and taken to Khorasan and Antioch, where they would endure wretched slavery under the worst masters imaginable. They underwent a torture much longer than that endured by those whose heads were severed swiftly by the sword." End quote.
The second group, known as the Prince's Crusade, was led by men of remarkable leadership abilities and would find a great deal of hard-fought success. Greatest among them was Godfrey of Bouillon. Hugh of Vermandois was one of the five leaders of the First Crusade, albeit not one of its best. Though he was largely an ineffectual commander, he contributed much by the way of his ability to recruit a very select group of noble knights from the area around Paris. Hugh's contingent left in August per the Pope's request. When he left, Hugh sent a message to Alexius. "Know, Emperor, that I am the King of Kings, the greatest of all beneath the heavens. It is my will that you should meet me on my arrival and receive me with the pomp and ceremony due my noble birth," end quote. Needless to say, Alexius was hardly impressed by this message. Hugh would quickly be humbled. Setting sail, Hugh's ships were all sunk. Many of his men died, and he was forced ashore, where Byzantine officials found him, quote, "bewildered and bedraggled," end quote. Hugh would partake of the capture of Antioch in 1098, then retreat to France. He was then shamed by the new pope, Pascal II, and threatened with excommunication for his refusal to fight. As a result, he went back to Palestine in 1101 and died there from wounds sustained in battle. Hugh was the brother of King Philip of France, who was ineligible for the Crusades because he had been excommunicated from the church. Hugh was encouraged to approach Philip, and Philip provided Hugh with men and money. Due to a copyist error, Hugh is known as Hugh Magnus, or Hugh the Great. His title was originally meant to be Hugh Minus, or Hugh the Younger. Indeed, there was nothing great about Hugh's character. He was extremely proud and arrogant, considered by most to be a completely ineffectual leader, and a poor military strategist. The only reason he was allowed to embark on the crusade in the first place was because he was wealthy and had a surplus of military soldiers. Godfrey of Bouillon, who is known as the Duke, was a much better leader and a much better man than Hugh. You can hear more about him in our latest Patreon exclusive episode of The Deus Vault. Godfrey was tall, blonde, and known for his exceptional piety and good character. By far the most spiritual of all the leaders from the First Crusade, the conquest of Jerusalem would have proved impossible without Godfrey. His exploits in the Holy Land were legendary. Godfrey's large army reached Constantinople in December 23, 1096. Next, Bohemond of Taranto was a massive Norman man who brought an elite Norman fighting force with him to Constantinople. Bohemond's arrival in Constantinople caused a considerable amount of friction. This was because Bohemond and his father had led a successful campaign into southern Italy in Sicily about a decade beforehand. Bohemond had personally defeated Alexius Comnenus several times in battle. Needless to say, the emperor was surprised to find Bohemond and a large Norman army at his doorstep. Bohemond arrived in April of 1097. Of Bohemond, Alexius's daughter Anna later wrote, "The sight of him inspired admiration, the mention of his name terror. His stature was such that he towered almost a full cubit, about 12 inches, over the tallest man. In fact, his real name was Mark, but his father had nicknamed him Bohemond after the mythical giant because of his great size, even as an infant." Anna also wrote, "He was slender of waist, perfectly proportioned. His skin was very white, his hair was lightish brown, and not so long as that of other barbarians. There was a certain charm about him, but it was somewhat dimmed by the alarm his whole person inspired. There was a hard, savage quality in his whole aspect, due, I suppose, to his great stature and his eyes. Even his laugh sounded like a threat to others. His arrogance was everywhere manifest. He was cunning, too. As the emperor would observe, Bohemond was the most experienced, talented, and politically astute commander among the crusaders, having learned his skills the hard way." Bohemond, Hugh, and Godfrey were soon joined by Raymond of Toulouse and Duke Robert of Normandy. They quickly reconquered the area surrounding Constantinople for Alexius, who then promptly abandoned them. He told them that Jerusalem was of no concern to the Byzantines, and the crusaders were free to retake the city if they so wished. Disgusted, the leaders of the First Crusade pushed on without the help of the emperor. They would refer to the emperor as "that wretched emperor," and such hostilities would ultimately lead to the sacking of Constantinople during the Fourth Crusade. It is hard to say exactly how many crusaders arrived in Constantinople. According to Stark, roughly 130,000 set out in 1096, but 90,000 did not take part in the siege of Nicaea in 1097. That is a loss rate of roughly 35 per mile who died or turned back. By the time Jerusalem was taken, perhaps as many as 115,000, or 88%, of the original crusaders had been lost. The total number of those who died probably totaled about 120,000. Of these grave losses of life, Stark writes, "It was not until the upper-class sons of Europe were slaughtered during World War I that Europe suffered the loss of a generation of leaders equal to that which took place during the First Crusade. Those who marched east were among the best and the brightest of their time. When they died, the responsibilities for managing many major estates and dealing with many important concerns fell upon widows and minor sons, and on those who failed to serve, just as it did in England, France, and Germany in the 1920s. Even so, commitment to crusading remained high for many more years as the families involved in the First Crusade continued to send their subsequent generations to defend the Holy Land. Indeed, when Europe began to sour on crusading, it appears that it was not the families who had given the most who lost heart. Rather, it was the families who had never sent a crusader who opposed continuing to pay the taxes required to sustain the crusader kingdoms," end quote. The King's Hall podcast exists to make self-ruled men who rule well and win the world.
Well, gentlemen, welcome to this episode of the King's Hall podcast. I am Eric Khan. I'm one of your hosts, joined today by Dan the Penniless.
In the penny list.
What?
We got to have names like that for
that's like not one that? I want, though.
Would you be, Dan Magnus?
I would rather be
the great Dan, the great
Dan Sid or something like that.
Dan
Sid. Did you know El Sid? So I was thinking about trimming my beard down a little bit. Mm-hmm. He had such a substantial beard that people thought it was a point of arrogance for the guy.
They thought he was me. That's crazy.
No, because he would throw it over his shoulder to do battle.
Like, well, you know what's crazy is the next Deus Vault is actually on El Cid.
Do you know
really?
What you know which what means real name is?
What?
Rodrigo Diaz de Vivar.
What a king.
Is it?
Yeah,
I thought it was just Spanish. El Cid. Spanish for the Cid.
The Cid is actually
Spanish for the Nino.
The Cid actually comes from the Muslims and it means the Lord.
No.
Yeah.
So the Muslims were like, I don't know who that guy is. Probably a god.
El Cid. Yeah, they hated him because he killed so many of them.
Man, I mean, that's a good reason to be hated.
What a king. We also have, speaking of kings, Brian Sauvet, the handsomest Frenchman that we could find.
You know, while we were recording that cold
open. The only one we could find.
First of all, thank you. One of the things I texted to my wife while we were recording that was, we are having another son, whatever it takes, and I'm naming him Godfrey. Because I'm French.
Are you going to name
him? He's
him?
Probably like among the greatest. That guy, humble, courageous. I just want a little Godfrey to go with my Alfred, you know?
Dude,
what a name.
That is.
Can you imagine having to call, like, I hey, Godfrey? Imagine. Golly.
Dude.
So I'm just letting you know.
That's
going to happen.
Let's go. Speaking of great names, Dan, you had the opportunity in the cold open to read Schultzenichen Pepper a few times.
Salts and peppers. Salts
yeah,
and
I did. Yeah.
How do you pronounce that now that you know?
Oh, Schultzenichen.
Oh, yeah. Everybody knows that.
Yeah, obviously.
I was pronouncing it Solzhenitsyn like forever.
Was that actually right?
Well, who knows?
Who knows?
You say it with confidence.
Oh, okay.
You just own it. Gentlemen, it's good to have you on this episode. Brian, before we jump in, we're going to be talking about the Crusades, obviously. It's kind of been a point of anticipation for us getting to this moment. Very excited to jump in. But one other thing I'm excited about is a little bit like a crusade. It's a conference.
It's a conference.
They
very
both
similar.
Start with C.
Yep.
And it's in
Christians involved
in Ogden, Utah. So Brian, sell me, pitch me.
Guys, you got to get out here. I mean, when this episode comes out, there's only going to be a few days left on our lower pricing. So our discounted rate ends like April 15th, which is a Monday. I think this is going to come out April 12th.
Yeah.
So I'm like April 12th. So you guys got a couple more days. Sign up. We've got hundreds of people coming out, brothers and sisters from across the nation. And really, to me, I mean, I think the conference is going to be great. But my favorite part about this kind of thing is getting to just hang out with like several hundred like-minded brothers from across the nation, when most of us exist in little bands of merry men, like of Robin Hood's outlaws in various Sherwood forests across the nation, hoping that the feds don't discover the GC. And we're going to get together and we're going to get together in an amazing
that
building.
That almost sounded like an Owen Strand rap.
That was almost like 1, 2, 3, 4. I declare the quicker the flicker, the quicker the trigger. Digging a dish is whatever. Anyway. It's going to be on the east bench, the mountainside of Ogden at Historic Ogden High School, right up the street from our church. We're going to have Dr. Stephen Wolf out, Dr. Joe Rigney. There's going to be psalm singing. There's going to be a singles mixer. There's going to be all sorts of great opportunities to meet and hang out with brothers and sisters, talking about King Alfred and the model that he gave us for establishing really thick, strong Christian communities that have defensive and offensive capability. So come join us. NewChristianImpress.com/conference. You can get that discounted rate. And like we've been saying, if the ticket cost is an issue, like, guys, we can't fly you all out. I can't like make your bed for you. But if cost is an issue on a ticket, email us. You can email. Who should they email?
They should email. They can do Cassie.
Yeah.
So Cassie at newchristendompress.com.
Yeah.
Dan is actually providing free lodging for everyone.
Is he really?
No, I'm kidding.
That's why they call him Dan Magnus.
Dan Magnus, because he's great And that's why people love you
what,
so much.
What Dan will do is he'll provide you with the addresses of all the local parks where you can camp
with the homeless people.
Because the homeless do. No, but email us if cost is an issue on the ticket and just tell us what you can do. And we'd love to have you. We want as many people as possible to come and hang out and benefit.
Yeah, I think it's going to be great. I think so far, Brian, you said there's like 600-ish souls that are.
Yeah, so far.
Signed up. One thing I do want to encourage people, maybe you already signed up. Maybe you haven't yet, but be sure to get a ticket to the Brian Sauvay Imagine Dragons concert.
Yeah, crossover. Imagine Dragons is now going to send us a cease and desist letter. So thanks for that. Yeah. Well, so a couple things. I'm going to be playing some live original songs in psalm settings. Some that you guys have heard on my releases, some that are not yet released. And we're trying actually to record a live album. Not just of that portion, but also I'm hoping that we're going to be able to produce a couple of live songs, singing the sea shanty as a huge group, singing some psalms. So if you want to go down in history and say, I was there, that was me singing really loud and off key right there at that moment that you hear in the live recording, that I own that. Okay. Come hang out.
Come hang out. We want it's going to be great.
Do you want to encourage people to like scream off key at key points?
Most of the time, it's not that they think they're off key. It's that they confidently think they're on the note.
Okay. Yeah, I'm always on.
We do have a rule at Refuge Church here in Ogden. When we're doing psalm sings, the rule is, look, if possible, know your part and sing it excellently. But the second option is not to be quiet if you don't know it. It's to pick a note and sing it with confidence.
Done.
Even if it's the wrong note. So, and the kids, man, they take me up on that every time I say it.
Every single time.
It's going to be great.
It's going to be great. Gentlemen, let's jump now into this episode, Crusades 1, the first crusade. Dan, I just kind of want to get your impression. You did a lot of the reading for the cold open. What is sort of the, what would C.S. Lewis say, the environment created in your mind that you kind of step into as you're thinking about the Crusades? What kind of frame of mind does it put you in?
Well, yeah, I mean, obviously, not having a lot of my education steeped in Crusades history, Middle Ages history, you're coming at it with fresh eyes to a degree, other than still dismantling the presuppositions that the Crusades were generally bad or unwarranted, you know. And then you start to read some of the accounts from like Alexius's, was it daughter, Anna?
Yeah.
Who talks about like, it, I wouldn't even say it's a hill of bones. But it's a mountain of bones of the slain. You know, it's just it's unbelievable the atrocities that were committed by the Muslims towards Christian people. And then the just utter disgust that I have, like bile in my mouth at the modern secularists who have then twisted it to say it was actually the Christians who are invading a multicultural, peaceful Islamic people. Not the other way around. Yeah. I mean, it just infuriates me. I'm upset. And so I'm also glad, though, that the Christians, they won First Crusade.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, we'll get into that in second half.
As the saying goes, gold is the money of kings. Silver is the money of gentlemen. But debt is the money of slaves. If you're tired of seeing your wealth sapped by the silent theft of inflation, consider adding gold to your financial plan. Gold and silver have been recognized as sound money and a store of wealth for centuries. Converting your savings into gold and silver will protect and preserve your wealth so that one day you'll be able to pass down a true inheritance to your children's children. That's where our friends at Alpine Gold Exchange come in, offering 0% buy-sell spread, gold leases with up to 3.5% annual return, paid in gold, by the way, and secure vaulting right here in Utah. Alpine Gold approaches every transaction with fairness, honesty, and respect, reflecting a strong Christian business ethic in all that they do. Head to ogden.gold today or tap the link in the description to sign up or schedule an appointment to speak with an Alpine Gold advisor today and see what would best serve your family. And just so you know, if you schedule a call, you'll be speaking with Jace, Ethan, or Stu, three members of Refuge Church right here in Ogden. Head to ogden.gold and check it out today.
Do you desire to be shrewd financially for the sake of your family and future generations? Well, we know that a robust society depends on getting this right. Success in building and passing on personal wealth. Let's be mature, responsible leaders with the resources God expects us to turn a profit on, to love our children and children's children well. Joe Garrisey with Backwards Planning Financial integrates investments, debt, insurance, tax strategies, and legacy planning in a holistic approach, coaching his clients to act wisely. You can do better than you received. You can affect your family's trajectory and maximize your efforts to set up long-term fruitfulness. Joe starts with your values and goals, then provides impactful counsel to help you form and implement your financial plan. Click on the link in the description for Backwards Planning Financial and contact Joe today to get started. Today's episode is sponsored by Premier Body Armor, your top choice for safeguarding your family. What sets them apart? Well, Premier isn't here to convince you to wear a plate carrier around town. Nope. They're focused on innovating armor right into your normal everyday life. Think bulletproof laptop case or lightweight armor insert that fits into your favorite bag and stops most handgun, shotgun, and even rifle ammunition. Unlike much of the tactical industry, choosing Premier Body Armor not only ensures that you're getting amazing armor, but you'll be doing business with a family-owned Christian company. Visit PremierBodyArmor.com today and use promo code KingsHall for 10% off your order today. Got questions? Reach out to customer service or send their president an email directly at alex@premierbodyarmor.com and you can speak to him yourself. Don't wait to invest your family's security, but reach out today to Premier Body Armor. Don't carry a bag? No worries. How about a moisture-wicking athletic t-shirt with minimalist and lightweight soft armor panels built in? Check the link in the show notes or visit premierbodyarmor.com today. Red meat is a staple of a healthy, protein-packed diet, but not all meat is created equal. That's why I buy my meat from Salt & Strings Butchery. Salt & Strings is owned and operated by my friends Quinn and Samantha Bible, and the meat they offer is raised, harvested, and processed exclusively in Southern Illinois. It's cut and packaged by my friends Quinn and Anthony, and not only is it the best meat I've ever had, well, all their meat is sourced from local farms that share our Christian values. Salt & Strings is now offering a beef and hog box that can be shipped directly to your door. The 15-pound beef box features 100% black Angus beef and includes ribeyes, T-bones, sirloin, chuck roast, fajita meat, and ground beef. You can order your beef box today for just $259. They will send it directly to your door. The hog box is $239 and features premium Duroc pork, including 8 thick pork chops, one of my all-time favorites, pork steaks, cured and sliced bacon, ground pork, bratwurst, and breakfast sausage links. You can place your order today at saltandstrings.com or use the link in the show notes. And also be sure to follow Salt & Strings on Instagram. We'll also include the link in the show notes.
But the defender of the Holy Sepulchre and my future son, Godfrey, we're going to get there. This quote from the cold open to your point,
yeah,
from Buchanan, when he said, many old heroes have not survived the killing fields of the new history. Ultimate goal, destroy patriotism, kill the love of country, demoralize the people, deconstruct America. History then will no longer unite and inspire us, but depress and divide us into the children of victims and the children of the villains of America's past.
Wow.
In two or three sentences, I think Buchanan captures, he wasn't talking about the Crusades. He was talking about American history. It's the same thing that they did to Christian American history.
It's the same play.
That's what they did. They turned the Muslims into the victims. And so you're the children of the victims, Muslims. And if you're Christians, if you're white, if you're European, if you're on this camp, if you're at all proud of the heritage of the Christian West and even the Christian East before that, then you are the sons of villains. Mm. What kind of world will that produce?
Yeah, and definitely cuts the heart out of the people. I love that first part of the quote, too. Solzhenitsyn said, to destroy a people, you must first sever their roots. And so I think, gentlemen, one of the things we have to realize is that this is malicious. There's wicked intent in this. And this is why I think as we've pushed back and we've fought and said, no, these are our heroes, these are our fathers in the faith, I think that it's inspired a lot of men in the reverse direction, sort of that white pill moment. Brian, I want to ask you, as you guys don't know this yet, but I've been Narnia maxing.
Oh, man. I didn't notice.
I didn't even notice. One of the books that I fell in love with, because it's the Marshall book, is Prince Caspian.
Oh, yes.
And one of the things I noticed in there was the parallels with what we're dealing with in this season, which is that you have the old Narnia, which is, you know, hundreds of years in the past at the point that you pick the story up. And all the teachers in Miraz and basically the Turks in that story, they have clouded the history. And so it's Caspian's nurse who's sent away because she was teaching him the true history of a magical Narnia.
Yeah, she was canceled.
She was. And then, of course, you have it was Dr. Cornelius.
The professor, yeah.
Who is secretly teaching these things on the top of the tower to Caspian. And so in a sort of way, it seems like that's really the work that we're trying to do is say, no, the old things are true.
Yeah.
They're not evil. And we have to sort of resurrect this old Narnia. I also think it's interesting in Caspian because the way that they win is by using the horn to call back the kings of old.
Yes.
And those kings and queens of old come back and help them with the victory. So in a way, we're just sort of doing that symbolically, metaphorically, but we're calling back these kings.
Yes.
To our day.
Yeah. Let's pick up Susan's horn. Let's give it a great blast and remember the heroes of the first Narnia. So that we can oust the villains of this modern Narnia that is deracinated. It's cut off from its roots. It is a conquer. It is a Narnia of conquerors who have come to destroy that which is good and beautiful. So I thought that was really like, I'm here for it. Eric has gone from saying every day, like, you know, Brian and Eric or Brian and Dan, it's kind of like in the Aeneid. And then and then a couple months later, it was, you know, in Good to Great or in the Chicago Bulls with Phil Jackson.
Yeah, that's right.
And now it's like, you guys, this really reminds me of a line from Reap a Cheap when he said, shall I draw my sword and run them through my King Caspian? And I think Eric has found his avatar in the person of Reap a Cheap.
No question. Like when Eustace turns into a dragon and Reap a Cheap says, Your Majesty, if I may. And he says, no, Reap a Cheap, you may not challenge him to single combat.
Last episode, it really cut deep when I said, everybody's read this except Eric.
And now he understands.
Eric's now read.
Yeah, he understands.
By the way, through tears, you know, is powerful stuff. And I think especially as we are going through the season, it's a lot of the same feelings. Lewis seemed to really capture, as did Buchanan, the importance of history. My question for you guys is, this has been the cultural Marxist push for over 50 years. My question to you is, why do you think it was so successful? Is it that Christians didn't fight it hard enough? But how did it get this deep in the culture?
I think that one of the things, we've come at this from multiple angles in this season so far, and one that I really want people to understand is the play that the enemy, the conquering enemies, will run on you, where they try to take your principles and then weaponize them against you. Mm. Because the Christian faith, think about Alfred the Great and who was his Guthrum, right? Mercy, where he's got this wicked, evil enemy. And Alfred the Great, part of the greatness of him was the greatness of mercy. Mm. He didn't always kill. He didn't always run through with the sword. He could forgive. He could make peace. He wasn't just a warrior. He was also a peacemaker. And so what the enemies will do, what Islam will do, because it is not a religion of peace, it's actually fundamentally a religion of total conquest and enslavement. That's what it is. Fundamentally, in its essence, not perverted by an extremist fringe, but in its essence, that's what it is.
It's jihadist.
It's jihadist.
Yeah.
The struggle against all other peoples until they've been subjugated into the name of their demon god and their false prophet. And so what they will do is they'll take the mercy of Christianity, which is true. It's a mercy that's true as steel. And they will attempt to make it into a weaponized fake mercy of empathy and of essentially softness, where they say, you know, but you really need to reckon with some of the foibles of your ancestors. And they weren't sinless now, were they? And that little crack in the door, because it's true, of course they weren't sinless. We're Christians. Only Christ is sinless, right? They will take that crack in the door and they will drive a wedge into it until they have undone, like Buchanan points out, and they've dimmed and tarnished all of the glories, and they've replaced them with this. This is a thing to be repented of: Christian greatness, Christian civilization, Christian rule, Christian conquest, Christian colonization is a thing to be repented of, not a thing that, though it was suffused with weakness and sin, as all human endeavors are under the sun, it was fundamentally great. It was fundamentally, in its essence, a good thing. It was glorious. So they remove all the glory. And to me, I think that's the play that we have to reckon with and understand, because they're going to keep doing it. They're not going to stop with the Crusades. They're not going to stop at any point. They're going to, with their universal acid of cynicism and demonic worship, they're going to dissolve all greatness of Christian faith until they conquer and call. And then, of course, secular conquest or Islamic conquest. Oh, that's fine. Any conquest but Christ's conquest. Mm-hmm. And that fundamentally reveals the reality that it really only is two sides. It's the kingdom of darkness and it's the kingdom of light at war with different proxy armies and different names and faces. But that's what you're seeing.
Yeah. The thing that you're highlighting, Saul Alinsky points out in his book, Rules for Radicals. It's rule number four. It says, make the enemy live up to its own book of rules. Mm-hmm. Make the enemy live up to its own book of rules. And so you see this weaponized Christian sympathy and, you know, Christian standards. Mm-hmm. Back on history, we're seeing that happen continually. So it's not just the Crusades. The Crusades, that happened a long time ago.
Yeah.
But more recently, you see that with the destruction of statues to Confederate commanders. Mm-hmm. and to monuments to men of the South, great godly men of the South.
Yeah.
And you can see that they're using this weaponized empathy against Christians by making them live up to their own book of rules. And quite honestly, a Christian that has a good theological foundation should be able to combat this fairly easily. Yeah. Like, you cannot manipulate me. I know my rules better than you know my rules. Yep. And in fact, you're not the lawgiver. You're not the one that should decree morality on me, pink-haired LGBTQ plus transgender person. I have a different rule giver. But instead, because of the degradation of the church and of the leadership of the church, it becomes much easier to manipulate people because it becomes more emotive instead of grounded in theology or grounded in the law of God and in the standards laid out in the scriptures and by our forefathers. Instead, now it's just emotive principles and emotive pressure that is being put on us, because at this point, we are ignorant of our history. We are ignorant of our theology. Well, we're ignorant of our church fathers.
Yeah, I totally agree with you, Dan. I want to ask you, though, what happens to a people who have no proud history or heroes? Like, what? And the reason I ask this is because I'm thinking back to Caspian again, right? That C.S. Lewis does such a phenomenal job of showing how miserable and enslaved the people are who have no heroes. And part of what happens is that Aslan comes and the kings and queens come back. And then people start that, like, the air changes.
Yeah.
And they start to act differently and they start to be heroic again and act courageously. But as you look at our culture, our society, what does it produce when you have no proud history or heroes?
And it's even just, like, specifically in what the Talmarines did in killing old Narnia. It's that they reduced Narnia to a materialist world.
Yes.
And they killed its soul. And so the reawakening is a spiritual reawakening to the true faith.
Yeah. And it's interesting because it's like they had to kill the magic. They're like, of course there's no lion. Are you dumb? And then, you know, of course, Aslan comes back.
Oops.
Spoiler alert. But yeah, Dan, just curious, like what?
Well, yeah, I think you see this in different story narratives, such as Narnia and some others, is that when you have a group of people, they have a shared mission and vision and cultural foundation. People, essentially, it's kind of like a hive where everybody is working together. They know their mission. Like a honeybee knows what he has to do. Some are getting pollen. Some are guarding. Some are tending brood. Like everybody is working together. As soon as the mission and the vision and the culture of a people is chopped off at the roots, essentially the history, the fathers, the kings, the great men, you have a people that, like Brian said, have lost their soul.
Yeah.
They don't exist for any purpose. So imagine with me for a moment, if you have a group of people that had a Christian foundation I had great leaders, great fathers in the faith, great kings and rulers and men, and they decided that they were going to cut off their past or have their past, allow their past to be cut off. What would you actually get in place of that? Well, you get a people that not only have lost their soul, but the result of that is that they actually hate themselves, not just their fathers, because that's what it's going to lead to. I despise my fathers. I despise my past. I'm ashamed of it. Well, what does guilt manipulation leave a person feeling? Guilty and manipulated and horrible and shamed. It makes you despise yourself, not just your fathers, but you despise yourself and you despise your neighbors as well. Mm-hmm. And so it leads to absolutely, it's a hell.
Why would you have children and replicate the villains? Well, why would you do that?
Yeah.
Why would you defend institutions?
You see this even on Twitter among Christians, though. It's like I'll post something on one of the Christian heroes, like, you know, Richard the Lionheart was one recently.
Yeah.
And inevitably Christians will start posting things on there like, well, you know, he did these things wrong and he's not as great as you think he was. Right. And
of course.
And if that is your framework for evaluating history, it doesn't really, as Brian's saying, doesn't really cause you to live up with hope to the future, because you're just, it's all going to be terrible, bad, disenchanted. Nobody is going to be able to actually accomplish anything great. Mm-hmm. It doesn't inspire
you. I wonder, in some ways, is it because of disbelief that men like Richard the Lionheart actually existed? Because could you imagine Richard the Lionheart? We didn't talk about him in this episode, but
also Deus Vault, check that out. Richard the Lionheart is live.
Oh, nice.
Yes.
Could you imagine him existing today?
Right.
One of the greatest men in history.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I have a hard time conceptualizing what would a man like that planted in our time and place today look like. It's almost unbelievable.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. Partly because one of the things that goes with the soul of the people and that comes in the door with self-hatred is the willingness to do violence. It's the willingness to wield the sword. Or in the sword literally, but also the sword of political power for its own self-interest. And this is the problem, is that Christians in generally in America, particularly in the West more generally, have lost the will to wield political power for their own good.
They think it's wrong to even do that.
They think it's actually wrong to do that. I think it's unchristian to Saul Alinsky's point, make them play by their own rules. Well, even get them to think that some of their rules are contrary to their actual rules. This is the problem with... think in America, what percentage of the Senate claims Christian faith? I think it's over 70.
Mm-hmm.
What percentage of America claims Christian faith? I think it's over 60 or 70. So right there, if Christians just, whatever cultural Christianity, every type of Christianity, Catholic, all like everyone said, we're gonna wield political power for our own self-interest. And they had any kind of unified culture and love for the past and a continuity with what had come before, America would be the greatest nation in the history of the world tomorrow. It just genuinely would, but we will not do that.
Yeah. I think one of the other sides to this, is education and children and media. So, you know, talking about really what you could call from a status level propaganda, but fundamentally what's happening in a culture, counterculture, you know, one punches, the other counter punches. This is really functionally what we're doing, is sort of like a truth war and a propaganda war. And it interests me, Dan, because in we talk about critical race theory, one of the key guys who came over from Germany in the Frankfurt School was Herbert Marcuse. And what did he do? So critical race theorist, you know, what we now would call wokeness, all that stuff. What did he do when he first came to America? He worked for the early CIA in propaganda. And then after that, he went into the university system and began teaching the new left, or the left at that time, which became the new left, teaching them progressive leftist tactics. Saul Alinsky and other things would be, you know, parallel. So my question is, as you look out, we're talking about crusades, is Islam a greater enemy right now, or is cultural propaganda by those in our own midst?
I have two competing ideas here.
Yeah.
One of the theories, and I've heard this before from others, is the idea, it's somewhat conspiratorial. So that's why I say I'm not as confident about it as
I am already more confident.
I like where this is going, and I believe it without with no any evidence. Qualifications yeah. or yeah. evidence.
And this idea is that Islam is merely a sword in the hand of a globalist elite. That is, Islam is used as a sword to destroy Christianity, and that it's a power. It's basically a weapon because Islam will go out and it will destroy everything in its wake. That's just what it does. It destroys history, culture. It destroys monuments, everything. It will totally. It is. What's the word? Christians argued about the destruction of icons. Iconoclastic. It's iconoclastic. It destroys everything everywhere. However, it doesn't rule. It doesn't do that well. When it's in charge, it doesn't create great empires. So they are great for the masses.
Certain players, cabals, have weaponized Islam.
Yeah, that they've intentionally
for one purpose,
and that's the destruction of Christian civilization. And so they will. You think about all the different ways this can happen. It's proxy war via immigration policy.
Just look at France today.
Yeah, they do this in Europe. You'll see this in America growingly. Is that the left seems intent upon the globalist elite, whatever you want to call it, seems intent upon allowing in anything that will do two things, secure its own power and to destroy Christian civilization. So the one theory is that Islam is not the greater threat because of that. It's just the weapon. It's like saying, which is the greater threat, the nuclear weapon or the finger on the button that launches it? Well, the finger on the button that launches it, right? The weapon is just a weapon. So I think that's, on the other hand, you could say, well, maybe it's not that direct. Maybe there's aspects of that and it's more complicated than that. The truth probably lies somewhere, you know, not quite that neat and tidy as history typically is, but there's some of that. And then there's also other forces. So my answer at the end of all of that is that the cultural propagandists, the global elite, the people who hate Christian civilization and want to secure their own globalist power, and steal all power and rule to themselves in a statist, wicked, omnipresent empire. I think those are the greatest enemies, and cultural propaganda and Islam are weapons in their hands.
Wait a minute. If that's true, then people like us would be like enemies of this cabal.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Who is the cabal? Why are they Jewish?
Damn.
I personally am offended.
I can't believe you'd say that.
I don't think it's universal.
No.
That's true.
I actually don't think, again, it's never that simple.
No.
It's never like, oh, yeah, it's just the blanks. It's just this one little. No, because here's the thing. There are really fundamentally two warring factions, not just in America or the West or in history, but in the cosmos.
Yes.
It is the forces of demonic, satanic darkness that hates God and his image bearers and will do anything to secure its own worship and the destruction of God and his image bearers. That wears a million different faces through history. Sometimes it's the Vikings. Sometimes it's the Jews.
Wait.
Sometimes it's the Romans. Sometimes it's you go down the line, the communists, sometimes it's, and they have a similar playbook and they have alliances and there's all sorts of different, it's the pornographers, it's the, you know, the central bankers, it's the, you can look all the way through at the fabric of the cosmos and its history. And what you will find is a cosmic war between Satanism and the living God.
The Kalermans.
Yeah. And it plays. Narnia. It's a great example because the Telmarines and the Calamans are a different people, but they're both function in the story in similar roles. They're allies in a sense because of that. So you get strange bedfellows in the globalist elite cabal that definitely rules the entire world. Strange bedfellows like communists and Muslims who should be on paper diametrically opposed to one another.
Yeah.
And yet clearly the one hand serves the other when it comes to the destruction of the Christian West. For certain. So that's my convoluted, controversial, conspiratorial answer to your question, Eric.
Agree, disagree, Dan?
All of it's true, 100%.
I was going to say, Brian, like when you finished, I was like, I believe it with all my heart. No question.
Yeah, I mean, I do.
It is now part of my identity.
I will now begin counter propaganda, you know, of the sword of Islam in the hand of the globalist elite cabal.
That's right. But I do want to ask the question, like we've done this with the Crusades. it seems like one of the most effective strategies is not even like the arguments are important. The history, reading the history is important. I think it's the way that like sort of the Chad King energy, you sort of have to just believe these things and assert them publicly and proudly. There's something about that. We've seen movements that do that well and they're unapologetic. Like we could say the same things and we're like, what if we did what typical evangelicals did? And we went in the public space and we're like, now I know that there, you know, a lot of people said a lot of bad things. And now I know this is hard to, for you. And, but hear me out, you know, here's some of the history. And I think that maybe you could, you know, be won over to these points. And
yeah,
but we don't do that.
Well, George W. Bush did that. He was a Christian, supposedly. And he was the one apologizing. Well, some of the blame for 9/11, certainly on the Muslims. It's interesting that he would say some of the blame was. Anyway, I'm not going to go down the 9/11 conspiratorial thread that I just
talking about cabals that use.
When I started reading the cold open and I was like, we're really going Two Towers. That's where this is going.
Well, they, you know, some people went Two Towers. That's right.
Yeah. Wow.
Who is actually in charge of that? Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Anyway, sorry to derail you, but.
Yeah. So I think when you look at things like White Boy Summer, and you look at movements like that, I think to the extent that they're effective, they're sort of this unapologetic. We're proud of who we are as, you know, Western civilization. And, you know, there's an ethos about it.
Yeah.
My question to you, Dan, is why is that important specifically juxtaposed against a church that is, even when it'll defend the Crusades, which it probably mostly doesn't, it's still kind of embarrassed or sheepish. Yeah. Why is that ethos so important?
Well, yeah, I think it goes back to what we talked about earlier with Brian saying that the enemy will make you live up to your own rules, is that you see in these tentative churches or in like big evil land, if you communicate in a way that's like, well, yeah, I know, you know, Robert E. Lee, yeah, he's fought for the South, whatever, but hear me out, whatever. You're allowing yourself to be manipulated and actually you're inviting attack. You're inviting attack. It's almost like, I don't know if Eric, you've experienced this in turkey hunting. Sometimes you get multiple turkeys that come in and you shoot one and turkey's not very smart. The one is flopping on the ground that you've just shot.
Go to attack
and the
it.
Others are like, they're puffed up and they start attacking the one that just got shot. They should run away. But anyway, that's kind of what happens, I think, to your big Eva emotionally a manipulated kind of effeminate churches is that they're flopping on the ground and they're inviting attack because they're weak. And so you need to stand on the principles of God. You need to stand confidently on the history of your fathers in the faith. And you need to assert that it's important to be righteous and it's important that it has to be true. But if you're convinced that something is true, why would you not proclaim it proudly?
Yeah.
Why would you, you know, ascend to the emotional manipulation of cultural Marxists and feel bad because your forefathers were great? Yeah. Some of them made mistakes. Great. So do I.
Yeah. You and me both. We're saying fundamentally, we will not let you determine the rules.
No, you don't set the terms.
By weaponizing what you think are our rules. They don't really think they're our rules, but they're weaponizing a false version of our rules. And so when they say you must hate, for example, we've talked about this in previous seasons, whiteness. Well, that's just a proxy war on the Christian empire. Christian West, which is a lot of European countries, it's in America, largely white. So they're not going to say hate Christians because that wouldn't be particularly effective as the say the quiet part out loud all the time. So instead they say hate whiteness because it's oppressive and something like White Boy Summer. What it's doing, and not everybody gets this, is that it's not actually answering one kind of partiality with a sinful partiality, because not all partiality is sinful. It's not answering one kind of sinful partiality with another. It's not saying, like, for example, therefore Christians ought to hate any non-white people.
Or what white people are intrinsically better.
What it's saying universally is, I reject the notion that whiteness is not a positive good to be celebrated in God's world and the story he wrote, and to celebrate its achievements and to preserve it as a good cultural thing in the same way that, like, I mean, we're going to talk about Christian Spain at some point in this history. And I would like to recover and promote Christian Spain and Spanishness as a positive good in the world that should
that's a,
be.
That's a Donegality.
That should exist, right?
You know Spanishness.
Because Spanish Christianity that reclaimed its land from Muslim conquest has its own Donegality. And it's something that is good and glorious. And if it rose to ascendance, the left would be doing the same thing about Spanishness that they're doing about whiteness. So white boy summer, this kind of thing, it's basically saying not only are we not going to be ashamed, we're actually going to loudly proclaim that we are the opposite of ashamed. We're quite pleased to be what God made us, to be white Christians descended from white Christian Europeans, even though it's funny that the chief white boy summer propagandist is Mexican. Or whatever. He's not actually Mexican, but
he's brown for sure.
He's definitely not white, you know?
Yeah. So,
which is, it's fun. Like people don't sometimes get Zoomer humor.
Well,
so they don't get the conversations that's happening at all times. And they're reading it through the lens of previous eras discourse. So they're reading it through Gen X and Boomer discourse. And they're thinking, well, this actually would greatly, flagrantly violate the rules of Boomer and Gen X discourse. Therefore, they must mean what we would have meant if we said that.
But it's super funny.
Yeah. Right. They would. They're thinking, oh, they're saying what we would have been saying had we said the same thing. But they're not. That Gen Z is not saying the same thing that the Boomers would have been saying with the same words, because it's a different rules of discourse.
Yeah, I think one of the connection points, this was our friend Santiago Pliego, was recently on Tucker Carlson, which is insane. But he was talking about a vibe shift. And this is why I think something like a vibe is so important.
Yeah.
And the vibe that we cultivate, even that just comes out of a friendship or friendships in the basement here, but encouraging other people to be audacious and bold and have sort of this similar... it's an ethos of going on the offensive and being,
Well, I think one key to
not
that,
on your heels,
you talk about the vibe shift. So when people try to manipulate you into feeling guilty, they're actually trying to make sure that there's no real progress,
right?
Other than immorality.
Well, and I think Dan, that's why he wasn't really great, or, you know, they killed a lot of, you know, the wrong people or whatever. That's all meant so that you won't actually do anything.
That's right. That's right. Because the important part of the vibe shift is to have a positive vision for the future.
Yes.
And to actually do something about it.
It's about action.
And they don't want you to do that. They don't want, they're killing your T, your testosterone. They don't want you to have kids. They are trying to end your generations. They are trying to make you be ashamed of your history. They don't want you to evangelize. They don't want you to have healthy churches. They don't want you to educate your kids because they don't want you to do anything. They don't want you to do anything. And so when you look back at these great men, what do? They risked everything. It was so expensive to go crusading.
Yeah.
They would definitely die, probably on the way, not even to the fight.
Well, if you follow those numbers from Rodney Stark, yeah, it's like 10,000 people made it home.
Small chance of success. Certainty of death. What are we waiting for?
Well, what did it say? Like 35 people died per mile.
Yeah.
And it's a lot of miles.
It's a lot of miles. They would travel all this way and they're exhausted and half starved when they get to the battle. And then they're like, let's fight.
And like,
what inspired those men to action? Why did they fight? And we can't even fight against the arena of ideas.
They wanted Muslims to stop enslaving, raping, and murdering Christians. They didn't want to make a bunch of money because they all lost their wealth. They all lost estates. During the Templar era, I mean, they mortgaged their whole estate and irreversibly, in many cases, damaged the intergenerational wealth building of their entire noble house.
America is built on the backs of hardworking blue-collar Americans. That's why we're so excited to join forces with MaxD Trailers, a Texas-based and family-owned company, to bring you this episode. We're proud to partner with MaxD to see the vision of New Christendom established, one small business at a time. MaxD builds innovative, hardworking trailers for the builders, fixers, and growers of the world. You can follow their stories by checking out MaxD Trailers on Instagram or by visiting the link in the show notes. Learn more about MaxD Trailers by visiting maxdtrailers.com, where you can check out the article, 10 Ways to Make Money with Your Trailer.
Are you a Christian struggling to find companies that align with your values and beliefs? Squirrely Joe's has you covered for all your coffee needs. All of their coffee is hand-selected and roasted fresh every day by a family of fellow believers. Try them out and you'll savor exceptional coffee while knowing that your investment supports a company committed to following God's teachings and upholding truth and righteousness, ensuring your hard-earned money contributes to the growth of God's kingdom. Stop giving your hard-earned dollars to pagans who support evil. We have a fantastic offer to our listeners. Your first bag of coffee is free. All you have to do is cover shipping. Head over to squirrelyjoes.com to claim your free bag of coffee.
Our sponsor, Private Family Banking Partners, is on a mission to help Christians live out the Dominion mandate by making a stealth-like move away from the mainstream banks and into their own privatized banking system. This innovative system is designed to guarantee uninterrupted compound interest and tax-free growth without exposure to typical stock market risks. To join this growing community that is already building wealth into future generations and converting post-mill talk into post-mill action, contact Private Family Banking partner Chuck De Laderante at his email, chuck@privatefamilybanking.com. Again, that's chuck@privatefamilybanking.com. To set up an appointment and to receive a free copy of Chuck's new book, Protect Your Money Now, How to Build Multi-Generational Wealth Outside of Wall Street and Avoid the Coming Banking Meltdown, go to the link in the show notes for more information.
Well, that the comment Stark makes about it until World War I, there wasn't as great a loss of European life in leadership in the next generation that was poured out for the sake of the Crusades. So, you know, we have this is part of the history that we have to unearth and tell the true story of, right, is that these were defensive campaigns, first and foremost. Some of the stories, I didn't include all of them. We'll get to some more later in the episode. But, I mean, the raping of nuns, what's going on? It's actually brutal to even think about. That story that was told about tying them to a post and having them march around while their intestines are slowly dragged out of them. But then I think, wow, that's horrible. And then I think recently there's even a vibe shift among some of the media elites. And here's what I mean. Dr. Phil did an episode with a whistleblower from, I think it was in the middle America, a clinic like St. Louis or Kansas City, where he talked to a whistleblower at a trans clinic about what they're doing to these kids. And it's every bit as barbaric as tying somebody to a post and having them walk around until their guts fall out. And I think about that, and I think we have real fights to fight today. But it's important how you come to this, Dan, of like just war theory. It boggles my mind, I guess. I want to ask you about this. Today, the church doesn't have a just war theory unless it's Israel or Ukraine.
Yeah.
We're not allowed to protect our own border. We're not allowed to fight for anything.
We can fight for ethno-nationalism even in Israel.
Right.
But not even just broad Christian nationalism. But
you've got Ben Shapiro calling for the extermination of an entire people group, and everybody's like golf clapping, you know, and you're like, wait a minute. Why is that the case? So my question is, what's the importance of a need for the church to recover not just war theory, but just war theory?
Well, yeah, I think this is one of the things I've been really thinking through a lot recently, the last 2 years probably. And I'm sure you guys are sick of hearing about it in some degrees, but is recovering or actually having a philosophy of Christian violence.
Yeah.
Like in what areas are Christians permittable to, is it permittable for Christians to be violent? That's really one of the core questions when you're looking at the Crusades, is because it's easy for the pietists to say, you know, like, or the pacifists to say like the Crusades universally wicked. Because Christians should not commit violence at all.
Well, you hear Christians today say violence is never the answer.
Right, right. And
seems like it was a lot.
Seems like it was. And God would say it is.
Yeah.
Like, especially for the state. I think that's really one of the issues that we're facing, though, in our time, is that the state has swallowed so much that it's become very difficult for us to execute justice because they don't. They refuse justice. Mm-hmm. And so we're not in the state sphere of authority. We're in the church sphere of authority as pastors of the church, of Refuge Church, not the church, but Refuge Church. And so we continually encounter issues that are anomalies in history because the state refuses to execute justice. And so likewise, in these areas where, you know, they're castrating kids, they're pulling babies apart because the state isn't doing their job in upholding God's law and justice.
I think the other important thing about the Crusades, I think you're right, is that you have leaders like Pope Urban, and you have leaders of countries and kings and nobles who are like, yes, we will band together and do this. So this ties into a kind of a final round of questions or question I want to ask. We'll get into another story about the Crusade here in a moment. But you see the People's Crusade, and it's sort of like populism today.
Yeah.
Right? The People's Crusade failed where the Prince's Crusade succeeded. And it seems like a lot of the reason is because the populist movements lack leadership. They lack nobility. And then you see somebody like Godfrey comes on the scene, and in Third Crusade, we'll see Richard the Lionheart. And because of that great leadership, because of their wealth, because of their ability to recruit people from different kingdoms, they succeeded. So I want to ask you if you kind of see a parallel with populism today versus I don't see the Prince's Crusade happening. I don't see the best that I can think of is like, who are leaders who are shaking things up today? The best I can think of is like an Elon Musk or a Donald Trump. And they're like, honestly, not that great. Yeah. They're definitely not Godfrey or Richard. So,
well, because they have the courage without the moral fabric.
Correct.
Right. They don't have the foundations.
Mm-hmm. So talk to me about the importance of leadership and an elite class that is actually doing righteous.
Well, yeah. So no matter
leadership.
Oh, that is actually currently doing leadership right now.
No. So if you're looking at the Prince's Crusade specifically,
right.
Why is it so important that it's not just a populist movement?
Yeah. Well, I think you could just look at take the temperature of our current culture right now, where we have a populist movement. Right. We don't have royalty. We don't have nobility. Well, we still do, but it's just they're not noble.
They're corrupt.
Yeah, they're corrupt. And so what happens when you have a culture that doesn't celebrate noble nobles, but instead you have celebrity, you know, you have Taylor Swift's, you have Kanye's, you have people like this that are actually leading the people. Even if they don't want it.
Most of them are mouthpieces for
the cabal.
Public figures, for less public powers. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think I unironically believe.
Well, the interesting thing here on leadership, just to throw this in, this is C.S. Lewis. He said, where men are forbidden to honor a king, they will honor millionaires, athletes, or film stars instead. Even famous prostitutes or gangsters. For spiritual nature, like bodily nature, will be served. Deny it food and it will gobble poison.
Yeah.
First of all, great.
I mean, that's amazing and true. But what ends up happening is you have a populist movement that doesn't amount to a hill of beans. They're not worth anything. And I think that's really leadership. Yeah, absolutely. It lacks leadership. What do good leaders do, Eric? You're the leadership guy. You're the leadership guru. Why is it so much more effective when you have good leaders than when you have a populist movement?
Yeah, I think fundamentally, and this is one of the reasons that, you know, in the course of my lifetime, I've become more and more disillusioned with this idea of liberal democracy, is because you see these great movements across history and Christendom, and it is a guy with power righteously taking the reins and not straw polling people, but saying, this is what God's word says. This is what we're doing. And I'm not talking about pastors merely. I'm talking about kings, people in the office of civil magistrate who have the power to do something. And then they go and they do it. Uh-huh. And that's what's instituted in the land. And I think when you look at guys like Godfrey, you look at, I mean, to a lesser extent, you had some other good leaders, Robert of Flanders and Bohemond the Norman is a phenomenal military leader.
As an inspirational military figure and leader.
And here's what I love about them. They sort of have it all, is how I would describe it. So they have the riz. They've got the charisma. Anna Comnenus, when she's talking about Bohemond, this is like the way teenage girls today talk about Ryan Gosling at times 100, right? She's like his aura, his presence, but then his competence on the battlefield, his ability to lead men. And what's interesting when you read a lot of the accounts of the emirs, right, about Richard the Lionheart, they called a lot of these men's sons of giants, Nephilim. We'll get into that in a little bit. But it's like they were heroic. This is what the Greco-Roman concept of a hero was, right? The whole point was that Aeneas isn't just every other guy. It's that to create a people and found a people and to sail across seas and to do this work is, it takes heroic effort. And so I think when you have those things and you have great leaders who inspire their men around a vision, around a mission, and then they go and show competence, it really is the glue. It's the heartbeat of any of these movements. If there's no Godfrey, they never take Jerusalem.
Yeah, this is why the Christian nationalism conversation is so important for Christians to wrap their heads around, because what you have right now in a lot of the like Christianity with testicles kind of world is a lot of ecclesiocentrism, which views the church as essentially this institution that swallows up everything. It's the first kingdom of God. It's all the like it's the first and only kind of realm, and it kind of swallows everything up. Instead of what I think is a more biblical and historical view of powers, where you also you do have the ecclesiastical sphere and government, and it has its own very particular ends and concerns in the greatest heavenly good for the members of the church. It operates by rules within that government with its own keys and powers for discipline. And you could read like chapter 30 of the Westminster Confession on Church Censures, where the church is, it discusses the powers within the government of the church, which include it's not Erastianism. It's not subservient to the state within these roles. It has genuine independent authority to exercise the keys of excommunication and discipline.
Even to counsel kings.
Right? Correct. But then where we're really weak right now is we try to actually sum up everything within that realm.
The church.
Instead of recognizing that there's also this other authority that is directly instituted by God, and it has different concerns. And when God gives authority, or when God gives responsibility, he also gives corresponding authority. So when the civil magistrate is given the responsibility of enforcing earthly good and justice, it comes with the authority with that responsibility in the wielding of the sword to carry out that earthly good. When you're operating within the sphere of the polis, of the earthly good in the political realm, you can't import the rules of the ecclesiastical sphere and play by those rules in the political sphere. It doesn't work because it's not intended to work that way. All right. And you also can't import the political rules and authority and weaponry into the governance of the church. Right. It's not the same thing. So you're going to have states of affairs where nations ought to defend their borders from people, and someone can't just come and say, you must let me in. Why? Because I'm a Christian. Well, no, the state doesn't operate by those same rules. It has different set of rules. In a similar way, the church can't say, well, you're not allowed in because you're Italian and this is a Polish church. Well, no, the church operates by a different set of governing principles because of the nature of its being and what it rules over. This was labyrinthine, but the whole point I'm trying to make is that what Christians are really bad at right now is understanding a category of Christian governance where Christians wield all of the, don't just take up the responsibilities of rule in the sphere of the polis, but they also wield the tools and authority that God gave to kings and to rulers and city fathers all the way up and all the way down. So Christian nationalism is really important because nations ought to actually govern for their own earthly good and self-interest. And what's happening right now in Saul Alinsky style is that any Christian who's attempting to wield political power for its own self-interest is being called proud and arrogant and self-interested. And they're attempting to make the polis play by the rules of the church. Mm. It's incoherent. It results in absurdity. Every time you try to live it out, it can't be done, which is why going back to the way that Christians governed during Christendom in, classical two kingdoms with what Stephen Wolfe is talking about a lot in his book. And you go back and you think they figured this stuff out. We don't have to reinvent a new 20th century version of all of this. That's probably going to be influenced by all of the errors of the 20th century and globalism anyway. And so people think that Christian nationalists are just being like really stubborn and like mule headed and annoying, and they're picking fights and they're doing all this stuff. What they're actually trying to say is, Christians in all these nations where we're supposedly Christians, you need to actually wield the power of the polis that God instituted righteously. And if you don't do it, you're sinning. You're not being patient and merciful and kind and all these things. You're being a dupe. You're getting played. You need to wield right. So to me, it's a perfect picture, the Prince's Crusade versus the People's Crusade. We actually need the Prince's Crusade. We need a recovery of a theology that could allow for a Prince's Crusade.
Yeah.
The state of affairs that would, because right now we don't even have the state of affairs where a Prince's Crusade could happen. We're three steps prior to that, which is why talking about like, oh yeah, let's form a militia, brother, and let's go do all this, it's actually not going to be helpful. It's not going to be helpful, because populism by itself is just going to lead to warlordism and all kinds of other problems, and probably be destroyed by the globalist state anyway, you know, 50 years before they ever get to that. What we need is to labor for the conditions in the political realm of the nation where we could have Christian princes.
Yeah.
Christian rulers.
Well, it was funny. You were talking about spheres, and I was thinking of a story, again, to plug for the Dave's Vault that's out this week. But Richard the Lionheart, he's going to Cyprus, and he's attempting to do battle with another Comnenus, Isaac, this time. And the priest comes to him, who's with him, and is like 200 ship armada. And he says, you know, this, there's too many of them. This is foolish. And Richard tells him, he says, priest, mind your books and your prayers. I will do the fighting.
Yeah. Which is, dude, the correct response.
And then he went and he captures Cyprus. Again, this is your one little spoiler for this episode. But Isaac said, I will surrender if you promise not to put me in iron chains. And he said, fine, I won't put you in iron chains. So he has his smithy work up some silver chains. And he puts those on him.
It's called a loophole.
So yeah, Dan, your thoughts on that People versus Princes Crusades? Any other closing?
I mean, we could talk about this to ad nauseum. I think this is a really important part to get. I really liked your, Brian, your point about militias, because the instinct is going to be, well, the state's not doing their job.
Yeah.
They are sinning. They are totally allowing rampant wickedness and harming my people. And so my job then is to become the state, is to do this, what the state's not doing.
Yeah.
And there may be a time for that in the future, but it's definitely not now. I don't think it's now. And so having a militia, what will that actually accomplish?
Nothing.
I mean, I think we have rights laid out in the Constitution for a well-organized militia, depending on what you think that means. But I think it has to be organized by a state in order to be considered a true militia.
It's not that you couldn't form a militia, like, and you're not saying this, you could form militias and train and be prepared for any situation that might arise.
Yes.
But what we're specifically saying is the time isn't now for Christians to form rogue armies.
Right. To go like take over the Salt Lake City, Capitol building.
And part of the reason.
I'm not saying that, by the way, CIA.
No, that's not. Well, I'm thinking about this episode and like how cancelable everything we've said for the last hour and a half basically is. But I actually don't think in prudence that's the play right
now. No,
I don't
not.
Think so. And there's lots of reasons in our area, too, is because we're 2%.
Well,
the population.
I think part of it, too, though, is you look at what's been effective in the last couple of years, however it shakes out, however he turns out to be as a player in the bigger power structures. But Elon Musk, somebody with power and money bought Twitter, which is now X. And because of that, many, many people on the right now have a voice. That voice gets through to people. I mean, guys, we were talking about this recently, but the number of people that we've talked to in high places who listen to one of our shows is actually quite remarkable. So I see a lot of the work that we're doing is this counter propaganda is important. Yes. Because it's mustard seeds that are planted in the hearts of men who, maybe it's a William Wolf who is one day going to rule in Washington.
Yeah.
Maybe it's other guys in similar type locations. When I hear of like senators, U.S. senators who are like, oh yeah, I've heard your podcast. And you're like, wait, what?
You're like, you've heard, wait, say that again?
Say that again?
Yeah.
So That's
gay,
where
gay
I
jokes and all.
Yeah. And they were like, they were some funny gay jokes you guys made. Michael, don't Knowles, tell anybody I said
Michael
that.
Michael Knowles has a segment on the Why Are You Gay? The where are we here?
I'm not gay no more.
Different one.
Oh, that's
different
the wrong gay one. Button. Where's my what?
You are gay.
Yeah, there we go.
There you go.
But Michael Knowles talking about that. You see sort of the conversation and the vibe shift mm-hmm. over just simple things like that. So that would be my encouragement, I think, to people is because a lot of people are saying, like, well, we don't have those princes right now. Here's what you do. You find Susan's horn.
You blow it.
Have you seen
you recall
well, what is Susan's
have you,
horn?
Have you seen National Treasure?
Yeah. Okay, this took a dive.
No, you Knights Templar, Susan's horn. We find the treasure,
what
we
is
find
Susan's
the horn.
Horn though,
no.
Eric?
Yeah, what is what Susan is Horns?
I think what we're doing now.
Susan Horns sounds like Susan, a woman's name.
Susan Horns.
It is. It is
English is my second language. I don't know if anyone knew that.
Guys, this is actually really important. Susan's horn is words.
Yes.
It's words. This is why you can't despise words. Words have far more power than swords over time because the words direct the swords. Over
yes,
time.
Yes.
That's why words are so important. That is Susan's horn. And that's why Christians need to not be cowardly around these subjects and actually need to just blow on Susan's horn and do it loudly.
Well,
Dan, you shouldn't have laughed at that because you made me laugh. You sullied my serious point.
One of the things we'll close with this as we jump into the Battle of Nicaea. But one of the things I think where you see this is St. Brendan's Academy, and we're doing Christian education. We've got a new podcast Kevin Love is hosting.
Yeah.
Encourage people to check that out. We'll have links in the show notes. But I look at our kids. Even today, I have times where I go out in public and, you know, you kind of dance around conversation when you're among normies. And, you know, recently in public with my sons, teenagers, and somebody asked them, they're like, oh, are you in high school? And they're like, yeah, kind of. They're like, oh, do you go to Ogden High School? And they're like, no, we go to St. Brennan's Classical Christian Academy. And they're like, oh, that sounds interesting. And they're like, yeah, do you want to hear about the Crusades? And they are just unashamed.
Yeah.
And I think what we have to do is the way that we as fathers tell history and we teach our sons, you have to raise a generation of John the Baptist who everybody thinks is weird and they don't care.
You know, someone was tweeting about this, I think this morning or last night. And they said, you think I'm abrasive in telling the truth? Just wait till my son becomes an adult.
Yeah.
He has no filter.
None.
You know, and there's an entire generation of people that have no filters.
It's how you,
that are very bold.
It's
is
how
what
you,
I mean.
You break the spell of the propaganda of making us live by a false version of our rules is you commit blasphemy. Not the real blasphemy, but you commit what they
against
think
cultural blasphemy.
Cultural yeah. blasphemy.
Well, thanks again for listening to this episode of the King's Hall podcast. We are going to stop the episode for now. We'll pick this up next episode. We're going to be talking about the Battle of Nicaea. We're going to be talking about the march toward Jerusalem and Godfrey's exploits there. So stay tuned for that. Be sure as well, if you're not yet a Patreon supporter, sign up on Patreon today for as little as $5 a month. You can get access to the Deus Vault. We've got Deus Vault exclusive Patreon episodes on Sir Godfrey. We also dropped this week Richard the Lionheart. So we've got wonderful content there for you. And again, we would just encourage you to check the link in the show notes. We would love to see you guys in Ogden, Utah, June 6th through 8th for the new Christendom Press conference. We're going to be talking about Alfred's Burrows. Again, follow the link in the show notes. You can sign up now for the conference. Sign up before the prices go up as we get closer to the conference. We've already got about 600 people signed up and many more by the day joining us, so be one of those. Until next time, festa nolente, make haste slowly.